Hi, everyone. Today I'll be speaking with Dr. Christy Kesslering. She's a pioneering oncologist who addresses cancer by taking a deep look into the metabolic health of the body. Her knowledge of diet and lifestyle optimizes her patients' recovery, and her protocols are great advice for prevention, too. I'm Robin. Stay tuned for Tributaries. Christy, labs are more and more available with more and more detailed information these days. Are you at a point where, depending on the kind of cancer and stage of growth, you can basically predict what the various markers might be? Or is this really a case-by-case and very varied bit of information?
That's a great question. I can guess a little bit, because as we know, cancers tend to be very metabolic diseases. So people who typically have very advanced, higher stage, more aggressive, tend to have markers that are higher in certain areas. So the metabolism markers, so I'm always looking at insulin resistance, insulin, a sister hormone of insulin called IGF-1 or insulin-like growth factor 1. And I'm looking at insulin resistance from a couple different points of view. We have a lot of information in cancer as how insulin and IGF-1 are kind of tumor growth factors. But there are other things that we can look at to get a sense of somebody's metabolic health. So a lot of people have standard cholesterol panels, but often their primary doctors or their cardiologists are only looking at LDL or maybe total cholesterol. But what's actually far more important is the triglycerides and the HDL. So we want triglycerides very low and we want HDL nice and high. And that balance, so if we have a very low triglyceride HDL ratio, that actually predicts for better outcomes. It's more insulin sensitive. And so a lot of patients that I'm seeing will have either glucose and insulin dysregulation, or maybe the triglycerides are quite elevated and HDL is quite low. I'm still looking at very similar labs, and I don't always know what I'm going to get when a patient walks through the door, but those are the most common. But there are a number of other markers kind of in that inflammatory avenue as well. So we're always looking at immune function, inflammation markers, as well as those insulin and metabolism markers.
Yeah, and I don't want to focus on what I'm going to say next, but I do want to honor you, I guess is a good word, Christy, in the work that you're doing, because so much more information can be known by someone like yourself who's practicing a kind of medicine that looks across the board. So that level of specialization that has happened is finally starting to reverse itself, and then doctors and medical practitioners can be better informed by knowing more about the whole body rather than just specializing in one certain kind of problem.
Yeah, and I certainly would hope that in our lifetimes we see it become more prevalent in conventional medicine. And, you know, I do see a growing body of conventional medicine docs that are looking a little bit deeper, as opposed to looking at conventional ranges and conventional measures. And, you know, so many times a patient walks into a doctor's office and are told everything looks great, even though the patient doesn't feel great,
right,
or maybe doesn't feel like they look great. You know, they're carrying extra weight or they have other symptoms. And we know that there are some diseases or findings like obesity and diabetes that do increase risk for cancer. But again, I always say, is it really those things that are increasing the risk, or is it that same underlying problem of insulin resistance?
Yes, and I think we're going to do a lot of jumping around today, but it'll all relate, I promise. One of my heroes is Dr. Otto Warburg, and he was, as I'm sure you know, a two-time recipient of the Nobel Prize for Medicine. And my admittedly non-medical and very basic understanding of his work is that once the cells go below the optimal levels of of oxygen at about 60% on average of optimal oxygen, the body will start creating diseases or start breaking down. And is there an answer why one body would go into a cancer and another might get rheumatoid arthritis, or is that question not quite even correct to ask?
Yeah, and I don't even know if it's, you know, truly the oxygen piece. What Otto Warburg found was that even in the presence of oxygen, these damaged cells started behaving very differently. They were behaving as if oxygen was not present and became more dependent upon glucose and what we would call the lactic acid pathway, so fermentation. But my gestalt, my gut is that it's really kind of our genetics to some degree, which kind of dictate which diseases we may get.
Mm, yes.
But it is not a genetic disease, right? It's those cells, the mitochondria, that are getting damaged from various things, our food, our smoking, our air, our toxins, our stress, our everything. So our mitochondria are getting damaged by these toxins, and the mitochondria are basically releasing smoke signals, you know, hey, we've got a problem here. And that those stress signals can then affect our DNA. They can turn on certain genes, turn off certain genes. So just because we have a gene doesn't mean we're going to get X, Y, or Z, which is why this whole genetic push over the last couple decades really has fallen flat, because it's not about the genes. It's about what we would call epigenetics, what genes are being turned on, what genes are being turned off, and what is the underlying cause of that, which I think Otto Warburg and a lot more, you know, Dr. Seyfried doing work and others in the field of looking at the mitochondria and how those affect disease.
Right. And just to throw in for a moment here about correlation and causation, I spoke with this doctor from Florida 20 plus years ago, and there were a lot of women, if they had breast implants, for instance, they felt like, oh, well, is it leaking? And this is causing a problem. And the correlation that he was making was that they were of the same demographic that were drinking lots and lots of diet soda and were getting all this aspartame in their systems. So it's really worth pursuing, isn't it, to look into, well, what's really a cause and what's really a correlation? And oftentimes we have to go way far down the line, don't we?
We do. When we see observations where we think we're seeing patterns, we can look at those different ways. So I don't know, I'm assuming you're familiar with the Bradford Hill criteria, but Bradford Hill, they set up a series of questions that you have to ask, that if you're seeing observational things, and maybe you're even seeing it repeatedly, does it meet all these criteria? Meaning that you know, is it consistent? Is it consistent from animals to people? Do we have a biochemical mechanism, or is there some way that we can evaluate that? And does it happen before the disease? And then is it dose dependent, meaning that, you know, the more dose, the higher the risk, et cetera. So like, we never did a randomized trial on smoking, right? But we knew that that risk was so high that the event was so big. And that's where I feel like some of the literature in the cancer and the insulin resistance, and even in other diseases in insulin resistance, there's a great book out there by Dr. Benjamin Bickman called Why We Get Sick. And he goes through insulin resistance in just about every disease known to man, and how that may be actually playing a role. And it really comes down to the degree of change. So if you're 10 times more likely to get X, then that is very likely causation.
Right.
But if it's 1.2 or 1.4 times, those are the numbers we hear all the time. Oh, you're 30% increased risk. Well, that's really only 1.3, and that's really not a high enough increase for us to say that that is actually causation. So now, okay, maybe there's a correlation. What else are those people doing? Or maybe it is causation and it's just a very small thing, but then we need far more data.
Yes, and due to someone's basic health line, it could be a cause for some and not for others.
Yeah, 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 who knows?
And I think that's why
the bigger the number, more likely it is, again, you know, and I think when we have common diseases, it tends to affect a lot more.
Yes, yes. Well, let's speak a little bit about inflammation and immune function. Where is the big relationship piece for you in working with cancer patients?
Well, we know that chronic inflammation, chronic trauma, chronic exposures to things that, again, traumas, and I always think about physical, but it's not always physical.
Right.
You know, sometimes it's under the hood. But we know that kind of repeated things can increase risk of cancer. Like, if you think about it, every time we are exposed to something or we have some kind of a trauma, we do get some damage in cells. Our normal healthy process is to go find damaged cells and fix them and heal them, right? We burn our skin, our immune system, and our rebuild, our proteins, and everything goes to work and fixes that skin. But the same thing should happen if we get some kind of a damage that would lead to a cancer. So sometimes it's that the inflammation or the insult is happening so often, i.e. poor diets, smoking, et cetera, on repeated every day, all day long type things, that we are actually creating an environment in our body of inflammation that our body just can't keep up with. We are just trying to live until tomorrow. We don't have time to, quote unquote, rest, digest,
right,
repair. So we're always in the let's just get us through today. But tomorrow never comes with the ability to stop and repair. So I do see quite a number of elevated inflammation markers in patients. In addition, then our immune system, right? Our immune system is supposed to be out there, again, finding pathogens that are not helpful to us to either get rid of them. Our immune system is looking, again, for damaged DNA, damaged tissues, et cetera. What can we go and clean up? But again, I think if we're always in that fight or flight mode,
right,
we are trying to quiet that inflammation. Maybe our gut is inflamed because of the foods that we're eating. And most of our immune system is along our gut. So if we are just on 24/7 keeping the moat protected,
right,
all of our soldiers are there along our gut and we're constantly using them, we start to become depleted and we have less resources to get throughout the rest of the body and deal with other insults and traumas. Because anything that we pull into our body, and that we talk about eating in GI tract, but we're breathing, we're putting things on our skin, we're maybe in poor environments. We should think about where we were before the modern world and what of those things are we still including in our lives.
Right, yes. And I've read that you look at inflammation markers differently. What have you discovered here? What are you doing?
Well, I'm looking at inflammation markers and really all lab markers with a slightly different eye, in that I'm looking at where would optimal be. Most of our lab reference ranges are looking at averages. And your lab may be different than my lab, and a lab in New York is going to look different. Those ranges are going to look different than a lab in the South, because it's taking, each lab is saying, hey, this was our average, and so therefore that's our range.
Right.
This is so.
And they change, don't they? I know cholesterol levels at one point, you know, years ago, it was one number, and today it's different. And it's exactly for that reason that you're talking about.
Well, interestingly, cholesterol's the opposite. So most ranges, so i.e. blood sugars, are slowly climbing. Triglycerides might be climbing. But LDL and total cholesterol, the ranges have actually decreased. They're lowering the top border because we have a medicine.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah, they're
changing. The lower they set it, the more people they can prescribe.
Exactly. Yes, yes. That's what I meant. They change them for their convenience.
So I think that if we have a medicine, we see different ways that the labs set the ranges. And if we don't have a medicine, they tend to just start to include the unhealthy. You know, most of us on the planet are actually unhealthy.
Right.
And so those reference ranges are really, really broad. Now, some of them are decent, but most of them are extremely broad. And if I could just go back to insulin for just 1 second, those really range. Like, I'll have one place that says 1.5 to 19. I'll have another place that'll say 2.5 to 25. And to be honest, I want people kind of in the 1.5 to maybe 4 range. I want you way down there at the bottom,
yes,
sometimes
yes.
even below the range they're giving us.
And wisely so, I would say. Are you satisfied with the glucose testing when you do panels on glucose testing?
To be honest, glucose is the last thing I look at, because your glucose could be normal, but your insulin is 24 to keep it normal. Again, I look at it because obviously if it's 123, that's a problem. So I usually, I use all the pieces. So I use the glucose, the insulin, the triglycerides, the HDL, and I have three different calculations that I use to say, okay, does this person have any signs of overt insulin resistance, even though to the conventional world they look perfect. And then I also look at symptoms. If somebody tells me they have brain fog, if somebody tells me they have an afternoon energy slump, if somebody tells me they get anxious or hangry in between meals, they have a problem, even if their numbers look perfect. And
right.
I do have those patients too. So it's a combination of history and labs. Labs will give us one piece of the puzzle, but it is one isolated point in time. And so that's why I typically will say with patients, we're not just doing this once, changing your diet and off you go. We're reassessing in another month. Where are these all going? Because some pieces are coming in the right direction and some pieces aren't. And then we have to say, like, what did we miss?
Right.
Did we miss addressing something? And oftentimes I find that, we haven't removed all of those products and the, processed foods, or we haven't addressed toxins, or we haven't addressed, maybe there's some gut pathogens that we're starting to see might be a problem.
Right, yes. Now, insulin is a huge topic. Well, I have a couple of questions about that. Let me ask, what's the significance of cancer cells having 6 to 24 times the number of insulin receptors than other? Is it simply that they just love bringing in the sugar?
They love sugar. But the reason is, we go back to Otto Warburg. The Warburg effect is when mitochondria become damaged. So we usually make all of our ATP, or the majority of our ATP, in the mitochondria. And when these mitochondria become damaged, our only source of fuel now in that cell, or a shifting priority of that, is glycolysis, or breaking down of glucose, but into lactic acid. And when we do that, we don't make very much ATP. We might make 2 moles of ATP compared to like 36 if we used our mitochondria. So now we have to operate at warp speed to make enough ATP. And in order to do that, we need more glucose. Well, the only way to get more glucose is to upregulate insulin receptors.
Right,
because insulin is the key to the door, right? So now the more aggressive the cell, the more dependent on that glycolytic pathway, the more insulin receptors that cell will have.
Right. Boy, every piece of health and disease is just so fascinating, and it's a perfect system. I hate to say that about disease, but I mean, just hearing that is just, there's a reason for everything, and there are reasons why we can shift what's going on in this situation. And certainly this is what you do 24/7, right? And is insulin resistance pretty much about diet?
I would say that it is mostly about diet. So I can correct insulin resistance in most patients just by helping them optimize their diet. But there are some patients who do everything that I have asked them to do, even like some additional significant tweaks, and we still are struggling with that.
What do you think is behind that?
Well, then we think about other things that can actually impact that. So extremely high cortisol levels. So if we are not addressing some other pieces, maybe we are living in a completely stressed out environment, maybe
yes.
stressed out family life. Maybe we're not sleeping. There is data in sleep deprivation, increasing insulin. Our night shift workers tend to have higher risks of insulin resistance. And we know that certain exercises will help improve it. So I think that even though diet is absolutely the foundation, I think that it's not always the only answer.
Right. Now, you just said some exercises.
Yeah. So movement is great. But actually, if we over-exercise, then we can actually get insulin resistance. So my
yes.
chronic marathoners, even though they might look lean, they may have a lot of visceral fat. They may have chronic inflammation, which is actually driving insulin resistance. They tend to be people who eat a lot of carbs, but there are plenty out there that now are doing it kind of in a more low-carb type fashion. But what we know from some randomized trials looking at just walking versus maybe just a steady state cardio versus truly doing kind of variable heart rate like HIIT exercises, the HIIT exercises actually have significantly more effect on lowering glucose and insulin. And steady state cardio really doesn't have much of an effect. So I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying that we might want to incorporate some variable intensity training.
Yes, yes. And I know some of these people who are the 100-mile racers and the intense cyclists, and some of them are swearing by being vegans, and we're going to move into after this question about being keto and a lot of the dietary protocols you recommend and have successfully done so. Do you expect to see them breaking down sooner than someone else, or are different bodies really truly going to thrive with different diets? Some no meat, some no dairy, just totally plant.
Yeah, I don't think anybody will thrive on a vegan diet. I think some people may feel better initially, but
yes.
a lot of times it's not what they are eating, but what they are not
exactly.
eating.
Yes, yes.
And then eventually, and what I have seen in my own patient population too, is the ones who have been vegan, they just ultimately break down. They start eating themselves. They become far too lean because we have only essential amino acids and essential fatty acids. That is protein and fat. And can you get them from plant sources? Yes, but they are less bioavailable. They're not in the form that we need them, so we have to be able to convert them. And some people don't have the genes to do that well. And then on top of that, they come with quite a bit of carbohydrate. All plant matter has carbohydrate. And so for those who do have some degree of insulin resistance, and are not able to burn the amount of carbohydrate. The reason some of these longer distance athletes can do that is because they're burning through so much glycogen or glucose
right.
every day that they have a little more room for carbohydrate. But it still doesn't mean that they're not going to introduce micronutrient deficiencies such as iron. Some of the fat-soluble vitamins, vitamin A, E, K, those are things that are typically found in butter and ghee and
yes.
beef fat. So I think that when we are trying to get our essential amino acids and fatty acids from plant-based sources, I think that we really run big risk.
And I do want to move on, but considering what you just said, I wanted to just throw out, I think that's the reason why fad diets come on so heavy and then they kind of disappear. Because when people do turn to the latest fad, they do start dropping all these other foods. So, you know, the things that really aren't good for us. I'd like to have you share some more now about the keto diet. And would you say what you are finding works well for your clients is, would you call it keto or a carnivore? Or maybe let's have not even a definition, but just sort of a broad scope of what you're seeing. And we'll take it from there.
Yeah, well, let me just back up and we'll kind of reiterate that almost every diet removes junk food. right?
Right.
That's the ticket, that terrible high-fat, high-carbohydrate combination food. Anytime we look at any diet, we may see some improvements in even glucose and insulin and other markers. But yes, I typically use what I would call kind of a real food ketogenic diet. There's a lot of versions, but in reality, a ketogenic diet is any way of eating that puts you into a fat-burning state where you are generating ketones, where you're not consuming glucose and you're not on the sugar roller coaster. There are people who are eating what a lot of people refer to as internet keto, which isn't necessarily a true ketogenic diet. So I am trying to optimize patients' dietary plans such that they're eating a real food, any sauces or condiments that they're maybe making themselves, unless they're very specific, and we're looking at labels on anything that does have a label. I'm trying to get people away from eating foods that come with labels. And I do tend to favor a slightly more animal-based or carnivore approach, in that what I have found in my own patients is that if we are struggling to get them into ketosis with a very restricted carbohydrate amount, if I tell them to cut out all plants, all of a sudden they're making ketones. And the rationale for that is there has been some discussion. A lot of times we see ketogenic diets published more as ratios and pie charts of this much fat or that much protein and this many carbs. But really, when we look at it more fully, so fat, although, yes, that's going to be now our fuel source, right, because we're going to either burn glucose or fat, we'll make enough glucose to live. Like, I know that there's some dietitians out there saying, oh, you have to eat at least 130 grams carbohydrate or you're going to die. And I will tell you, you won't. I don't even eat that. I don't know in how many days, weeks, but there is a ratio called the ketogenic ratio, where it looks at the ketogenic potential versus the insulinogenic potential. So we want ketones, we want less insulin. And what that ratio would indicate is that for every 1 gram of carbohydrate that you give up, you forego, you can eat 2 grams of protein. So and still be at the same ratio. So you could imagine if you gave up all your carbohydrates and you only upped your protein maybe a little bit more, you would be making far more ketones and far less insulin. But there are some people who do have a lot of inflammation from certain plants. And sometimes I take away things that would fall into quote unquote a keto diet, like unflavored almond milk. I'll tell someone, don't eat that. That's a product. That's processed food.
Right.
And they stop eating that, and all of a sudden they feel like $1 million.
Right. And drop a few pounds, so, right?
And may drop a few pounds, for sure, right? Because if they are being inflamed by some food, we often will be carrying some what we would call inflammation weight, water weight, right? Most people, they start a new diet, and they lose a few pounds right off the bat, maybe even dramatic pounds. But most of that is that water weight, that inflammation weight.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's about trying to optimize that metabolism. And interestingly, ketogenic diets have been shown to improve body composition, even in our sickest cancer patients. So it stops cachexia. Cachexia is muscle wasting, fat and muscle wasting. But yeah, so it's very impressive.
Indeed. And Christy, what can you share to address the thinking that our digestive tract is too long to break down meat, and also that it creates an acidic system when we're looking to be more alkaline? Does it come down to a body type or a direct result of gut health? Three questions in one.
Actually, I think we have misinterpreted the information and we don't have the full science behind where these myths actually come up. In order to actually be more of a plant-based eater, like our herbivores and like our primate family there, the ruminant animals, most of the herbivores have a large foregut. They have multiple chambered stomachs, and that allows them to actually process all of the indigestible plant material. So they do lots of work in our primate groups. Koalas, etc., they actually have a very large cecum or large intestine, so more of a hindgut, and that's where their bacteria act on that fiber to create actually fat, short chain fatty acids. So even though they're eating lots of plants, they actually are eating a high fat diet. Very interesting, right?
Yes.
For us, we actually have a very long small intestine, which is actually where most of the processing and absorption happens from meat, from animal-based products. So we have a gut that's actually more aligned with that of a carnivore. We actually are flexible in that we can process some plant foods, but in reality, those are probably our backup foods. We can live on them, but we can't thrive on them. And that comes to the pH piece, our stomach acid, very, very acidic, typically in a pH of about 1.5 to 2-ish. And that is to help, A, digest our food, break down that meat or other product that we're eating. And it is also meant to kill pathogens that are coming in along our GI tract. So things that are maybe we're not eating the best meat or vegetable or something, so we have some pathogens on there, and our stomach acid is meant to help stop that process, but also help us digest our foods. So where this whole pH thing gets a little bit wonky is we hear all the time, like, oh, cancer grows in an acidic environment. But if you recall, we talked about how when we have damaged mitochondria, we start upregulating our glucose to lactic acid pathway. As our cells are struggling, or as we are consuming more and more glucose, we are using that glucose burning cycle over and over and over. We're creating more damage in the system. We might have other things coming in to damage the system, but we start to deactivate, break down, handcuff our mitochondria, and therefore our glucose metabolism starts to create lactic acid, i.e. acidity in the cells.
Yes.
So it's not so much the food that we are eating and what is the acid or base balance of the food, because really all of that gets turned into acid in our stomach, but rather what are our cells doing? And I will tell you, I'm not a fan necessarily of checking urine pH. Urine is really just trying to excrete, you know, balance out the system. What I am a fan of, and I don't do it often, but I've always checked because of this controversy or this question, this myth, is I will check my saliva pH, and I am routinely 7, 7.2, 7.5, and not eating any plant material most of the time. So it's more about what are your cells living in, but that is not about eating alkaline foods. It is about getting your mitochondria healthy. I often will come up on the fiber question too. One thing that I think we can always come back to is if carbohydrates and plants were so important to us, why are they actually non-essential? We have essential amino acids. We have essential fatty acids. We have no such thing as an essential carbohydrate. So although we can use them and it's fun to use them, sometimes they're very delicious depending on how you prepare them. And it's fun sometimes to see color and texture and other things on your plate. But the question is it actually optimal or necessary for optimal health?
Have you ever seen pHs go too high?
Yes and no. I have seen people's urine go high, but again, their urine is trying to balance out their cells. And some people think that that's a good thing. Oh, my urine is alkaline. Yay. But what I see more commonly be the problem is people drinking alkaline waters. And what they're doing is essentially neutralizing their stomach acid. So now when they go to eat, especially meats and such, they're not digesting. And maybe they're actually bringing in pathogens. And now we end up with what's known as leaky gut. You know, we end up with gut inflammations because we've actually hiccuped our whole GI tract.
I'm wondering, do you see the glyphosate numbers in the body go down the more keto or carnivore the diet is?
So I believe, yes. I will say that you could certainly have glyphosate from other reasons. So maybe you live on a golf course. Maybe you do your own lawn care and you use a bunch of Roundup. So it depends on what your exposures are.
Of course, yeah.
But I do have some patients who have chosen not to do anything other than change diet, and we've seen quite a number of their toxin levels decrease. There was a study done in Canada a number of years ago, just looking at their food system. And again, not looking at anything organic or, you know, it was just, here's our food system. It was right kind of when all the glyphosate data came out and there was some concern by the population that, oh my gosh, are we all killing ourselves? And they, and so they did glyphosate testing and they found that all the plants contained some level of glyphosate. Now they stated, oh, but they're all within what would be considered safe. But in the animals, they didn't find any. So I don't know that that's been repeated. I don't know if that's real.
Wow, that's kind of fascinating.
Very compelling.
Yes, yeah. Wow. So are toxins like glyphosate, are they stored in fat?
That's what we think, yes, that they are stored in fat. And so in theory, if you're dumping a lot of fat really quickly, your body has to process and detox that. So we don't want to maybe overdo that. But I usually put patients just on gentle binders or other elements to see what can we do to pull those things out.
What would a binder be that you might use?
There's a number of products. So there's activated charcoal. There's combo products like GI detox. There's Cellcore product line. There's humic fulvic acid.
There's, I use clay.
There's a number. Clay, yeah.
I think so clay is pretty potent, yeah.
Yeah.
Your whole practice, Chrissy, is so great because your whole focus is to bring the person to a place where they're as strong as possible, especially if their choice is made to do chemo or radiation. Have you seen the keto-based diet? I mean, I don't want to fall into any definition, but we'll roll with how you just spoke about it.
Yeah.
Have you seen this across the board? Have people's numbers change and bring them back into a better balance?
Well, I will say the first thing that people will say is that they're already feeling better. I've had patients say, I feel better now with my cancer diagnosis than I felt prior, you know, than I've ever felt in my adult life or whatever. So number one, we know they're getting healthier because they're feeling better. They're living their day-to-days better. I have some anecdotal things, but if we look at the literature, because I think that's really where we should go, is when we use, and again, these are all small trials. No one wants to pay for diet trials.
Right.
When we look at the literature that's out there, what we see is that a lot of times it's used kind of in stage four cancer patients. There's some where no chemotherapy was given at all. They were just on best supportive care. And those patients who were able to get into a ketogenic state and lower their insulin seem to have stabilization or improvement in their disease, while those that did not continued to progress. There is data in stage four colon cancer when they were given chemotherapy that those who were on a ketogenic diet had significantly better response rates and even up to 50% complete responders, whereas those on the conventional diet, they did have some responses, but none were complete responses. There is data that when patients use fasting or fasting mimicking diets, and again, a ketogenic diet is another fasting mimicking diet. That's why it was designed to mimic fasting. Some of the studies use plain water fasting, others use severe calorie restriction to put them into ketosis, but only for a couple days around the chemotherapies. But what they found in that group was that they tolerated chemotherapy better. They had less hospitalizations, less symptoms associated with treatment. And in the larger breast cancer group, I believe they weren't even put on the steroids, which are often used around chemotherapy, right? But what do steroids do? Raise blood sugar and insulin.
Right, yes.
So,
well, you know, you can talk anecdotal things with me all day long because I'm a believer. I heard one time that the plural of anecdote is data.
Absolutely. Yeah, certainly do I have patients out there that use it. Yes. You know, if somebody's going to go through radiation, are they still going to get radiation changes in their skin or otherwise? Yes. I did have an endometrial cancer patient where we were doing radiation to her pelvis. She had zero symptoms during her course of radiation, which is really unheard of.
Yes.
I just recently saw one of my breast cancer patients who just finished radiation. She thought she had pretty significant radiation change in her skin, but the team at the center said, oh my God, your skin looks so good. And 2 weeks later, I'm seeing her and she goes, oh yeah, it's pretty much all gone. And I'm like, wow, because normally I would see patients back a month later, and I would still be able to see some residual. They'd be mostly better. So I think she did heal extremely well and had less reaction than the average Joe. But again, it's really hard to grade those.
Of course,
things.
Yes.
So when we look at radiation side effects, it can often be associated with the size of the patient, the area that we're radiating, the volume that we're radiating. And so there's so many radiation techniques that can impact outcomes. But then on top of it, I do think that the main thing I would hear is that patients really felt like they maintained their energy levels during treatment. And that's a big one.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, is there anything you'd like to share in closing that has just popped into your head and you feel like, I just really want to mention this?
I guess what I would really love to say is that prevention, right? An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Like, I wish that everybody would look under the hood and understand where their numbers are today.
Yes.
And what can we do to optimize them so that we're not dealing with a cancer or a serious diagnosis down the road.
Quite a pleasure to chat with Dr. Christy Kesslering. Medicine is moving forward in places in great ways. For anything tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.